Text 28 reads, then he described the occupational duties of different orders and statuses of life, citing instances from history, for he himself was well acquainted with the truth. In order to understand how to perform varieties of duties, there's the textbook explanation and then there's the example. There's the precept and there's the example. So Bhishma Dev gave the precept, then he also gave examples. They knew how to apply the precept to the example to the precept. He knew how to move between concept and reality. And so in this way, he instructed. And in this way, Mahabharata and Ramayana and the epics of the lives of great saintly persons, this is where it's of value, specifically of value, because it gives us example. Even on both sides, just like in Mahabharata, live like Duryodhana, you'll be destroyed. Even you may appear to be temporarily victorious because you were tricky. Because the law of dharma or the law of karma prevails, the wicked person will be destroyed. And it's always the case. Always the case. So how to be discriminating or discerning how to live a better way than one is presently living. The scriptures give us example as well as the precept. So Bhishma Dev presented both to Maharaj Yudhisthira. That ends the section. It ends the section because just at that particular time, the stun started moving in a different direction. Not from east to west, instead from west to east. The sun, the earth spins on its orbit, and the orbit is on an axis. So as it spins on its axis, right, you know this fact. Something like 23.5 degrees. There's a straight up and then there's the axis of the earth. And as the earth spins, there's day and night. Okay? So there's the motion of the earth spinning. And the Copernicus system is the sun is stationary, and in addition to the earth spinning, the earth moves around the sun. Right? That's Copernicus. That's the Western system. The sun is at the center of the solar system, and the planets move around the sun. The Vedic perspective is from the point of observation, that's this earth. If we think of it's relative motion. If the earth is stationary, then we can think of the sun moving, circumambulating in a near circular, kind of elliptical path, moving around the earth. And then the planets moving around the sun. That's the Vedic cosmology. Geocentric is called. If I had a big drawing board, I would show how this works. But from the earth-centered picture of motion, here's a, you can't see it, but here's a board. And here's a circle, and that circle is the Earth. And there's the North Pole, and there's the South Pole of the circle. And its pole is tilted a little bit. So when for those who live in the Northern Hemisphere, that's the northern half of the Earth, sometime in June, it's midsummer. That's when the sun is in the northernmost part of the northern hemisphere. It's called the summer solstice. And then the sun starts to move in a southerly direction towards the equator. Out of the northern hemisphere towards the equator, it passes the equator at a time when the day and nights are equal. During the summer, the days are longest, the nights are shortest. And then it moves south on the path called the ecliptic. It crosses the equator, and when it crosses the equator, the day and nights are equal. It's called equinox. And it keeps moving into the southern hemisphere. And it keeps going further south and further south and further south until it hits the furthermost south point. That's called the winter solstice, where the nights are longest and the days are shortest. Makara Sankranti. January 14th, something like that. And then at that point, the sun starts moving in a northerly direction. Still in the southern hemisphere, but towards the equator. Now we're on the back side of the Earth, if you're looking from this side. And it crosses the equator again, another equinox. It keeps going in a northerly direction into the northern hemisphere, and to the northernmost part of that northern hemisphere again is the summer solstice. That's 1 year. Every 365 days, the sun travels on that path. From the Vedic perspective, that's the ecliptic. And then the planets that move around the sun, as the sun is moving around the Earth, they make this, it's called a helix or spiral pattern. So if you were to map out the motion of the planets moving around the sun as the sun moves around the Earth, you get that kind of a pattern, spiral pattern. And according to Vedic astronomy and according to modern Western astronomy, the plane that the sun moves on and the plane that the planets moving around the sun move on is almost the same plane. Little variation. But when you take the whole universe, it's like it's the same plane. And that plane that the sun moves on and that the planets move on, the planets of our solar system move on, that's called Bhumandala. For those of you that like science. When you hear in Bhagavatam Bhumandala, that's what it is. It's the plane that's the path of the sun, the ecliptic, and the path of the planets moving around the sun in our solar system. The plane. And it's right around the middle part of this universe. Not just the middle part of the Earth, but the middle part of the universe. So then above Bhumandala, there's other regions of planets. Bhu, Bhuvar, and Svargaloka. Bhuloka, Bhuvarloka, and Svargaloka. We've all heard these terms from Gayatri Mantra. And above Svargaloka, there's Maharloka, Janaloka, Tapaloka, and Satyaloka. And that's the seven planetary systems that are in the upper half of our universe. And then there's seven in the lower half of the universe, and you have the universe. You have the structure of the universe. So that which marks the midway position is Bhumandala. We're in the middle planetary system. Just above, because 14 is even, 7 and 7, we're just above the middle. Little science class this evening. How did I get into that? Yeah. In these histories, Prabhupada explains, some of these histories in Ramayana, and for that matter, Mahabharata and the Puranas, sometimes they're describing activities that are taking place on Bhumandala. Sometimes they're describing activities that are taking place in other regions of the universe. Because sages such as Vyas and Valmiki, they're not limited by time and space like we're limited by time and space. They can, Valmiki, Vyas, is Trikala Gya. As much as we can understand, or better than we can understand what's happening at this moment, Vyas can understand what's happening at this moment, and any moment past, and any moment future. He can move laterally through time and through space without restriction, and know perfectly well while sitting in one place. Pretty mystical. But he knows how to do it, and he's empowered to do it. And so he can compose the Puranas where he knows perfectly at another time in another place exactly what's going on, because he can be there, or he can be aware. He can be conscious as much as we're conscious of this time in this place, or better than we're conscious of this time in this place, because he doesn't have any filters. And we have all the modes of nature filters and material conception filters and so many filters. And Bhishma was well conversant in that knowledge. And the applied knowledge, the histories were to explain the precept. Oh, this is how I got into it. Bhishma Dev was describing all of these occupational duties, and then the sun started to move in a northerly direction. So besides being very learned and besides being a great fighter, Bhishma Dev was a great yogi. Now apparently, everyone was trained in these principles. Even if it wasn't the process for Dwarapa Yug, still they were trained. In Satya Yug, where Shukadev Goswami is describing Kardama Muni and Devahuti and their betrothal, he describes Kardama Muni as a Mahayogi and Devahuti as a yogi she was equipped with the each of the stages of the Eightfold Yoga system. She had it down, up to Samadhi. That's before she married Kardama Muni. But Kardama Muni was better. He was a Mahayogi. More than self-realized. He had the capacity to manifest mystic cities, and his consciousness was completely fixed upon the personality of Godhead. And the combination of those two produced nine wonderful daughters and one wonderful son in the form of Lord Kapila. And those nine wonderful daughters were betrothed to three great sages who, early in the beginnings of the day of Brahma, they were taking on the responsibility of performing, producing good offspring to populate the planet, which would then produce other good offspring. They were Prajapatis, in other words. So, Grandfather Bhishma, he was a Kshatriya, but he was also, and the greatest glory of Bhishma Deva was his pure devotion to Krishna. But he was decorated with other incredible qualifications. So he knew, as a great yogi, he hadn't read Bhagavad Gita because it hadn't been spoken yet. But he knew, explains, the science is there, that when the sun Uttarayana, when the sun moves in its northerly direction, that's a signal for yogis to celebrate, because that's the time when the yogi, when fixed, they're fixing their concentration upon the Supreme, and they give up their body as the sun is moving in that northerly direction. They follow the path of the sun and enter into the kingdom of God. The verse says, this period is desired by mystics who die at their will. Now, it's pretty mystical just to be able to die at your will. Now, who will to die? But when it's an auspicious time, no problem. Give up this bag. Give up this body that's just causing us problems. Let go of it and go to the spiritual world. So this is desired by those who can give up their body at will. Can anybody think of any other yogis or elevated souls that had that capacity to give up their body at will? Dadichi. What can you remember about Dadichi giving up his body? Huh? Yeah, Lord Vishnu told Indra, go to Dadichi. He's very elevated. Just ask him for the bones of his body. And he'll give them to you. But he didn't just take the bones out of his body and have a lump of flesh. He just gave up his body. He just entered into trance, gave up his body, and so that Vishnu, so that Indra could have his bones. Just at will. And they watched, and his soul ascended into the kingdom of God. So if he could do that at will, why would he hang around? Wait for Indra to come along and ask for his bones. Because for such a person, in the body, out of the body, what does it matter? They could serve Krishna here, serve Krishna there, serving Krishna. And that's Bhishma's case. Bhishma was serving Krishna. He was an unalloyed devotee of Krishna, serving Krishna. And so he used his body. And the use of his body, use of one's body, means extending consciousness through the body and out of the body through the senses, the eyes, the ears, the nose, the tongue for tasting and vibrating, the sense of touch. Consciousness is extended, and he was extending his consciousness for service to Krishna's devotees, the Pandavas. He was giving a Srimad Bhagavatam class to Maharaj Yudhisthira at a time when normally you don't do things like that. You just fix your consciousness upon the Supreme and hold on for dear life. Krishna. But he was extending consciousness. But then when the sun started moving into the northerly direction, he withdrew consciousness and fixed his consciousness completely upon Krishna. He was fixing his consciousness upon Krishna in one way, through devotional service. But at will, he could withdraw that activity and in a neutral state, fix his mind upon Krishna. And that's what he did. Thereupon, that man who spoke on different subjects with thousands of meanings and who fought on thousands of battlefields and protected thousands of men. Even the poetry is nice, huh? Sanskrit is also very poetic. He stopped speaking and, being completely freed from bondage, withdrew his mind from everything else and fixed his wide open eyes upon the original personality of Godhead. Sri Krishna, who stood before him, four-handed, dressed in yellow garments that glittered and shined. Even the voices, the verses, poetry. The Srimad Bhagavatam is more than narrations. It's wonderful, transcendental poetry. In the purport, Prabhupada translates in language other than we find in Bhagavad Gita. He paraphrases the 8th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, starting with 8.5 through 8.15, 11 verses, describing the passing of the soul and the consequence of fixing the yogi, fixing his mind completely upon the personality of Godhead. At that moment of death, he's transferred to the kingdom of God. That's the objective of the yoga system, attaining the supreme, chapter 8. Purushottama Yoga. The yogic situation is that of detachment from all sensual engagements. Bhishma Deva was describing that the Varnashram system is also a process of detachment. So whether one is active in Varnashram system or inactive in the yoga system, the objective is detachment. The Varnashram system is superior because it purifies the mind and senses by the very activity. And the yoga system is inferior because one is struggling to fix the mind, but the mind is still impure, and the senses are agitated because they're not pure, because they haven't been purified by devotional service. Varnashram system is superior. And therefore, Krishna says, yoga, but in all situations of life, my dear Arjuna, be a yogi, and of all yogas, the best yoga is Shadhavan Bhajate Yomam Samayukta Uttama Mataha. Sri Bhishma Dev attained the perfection of quitting his body at will and was fortunate enough to have Lord Krishna, the object of his attention, personally present at the time of death. He therefore fixed his open eyes upon him. He wanted to see Sri Krishna for a long time out of his spontaneous love for him. Because he was a pure devotee, he had very little to do with the detailed performance of yogic principles. He didn't go off to the mountains and do hatha yoga for 10,000 years. He was a devotee. But although a devotee, he was fixed in the same capacity. You understand the distinction here? Simple bhakti yoga is enough to bring about perfection. Therefore, the ardent desire of Bhishma Deva was to see the person of Sri Krishna, the most lovable object, and by the grace of the Lord, Bhishma Deva had this opportunity at the last stage of his breathing. Okay, so Bhagavatam class is over for Bhishma Dev. He's now silent, at least in that he's going to speak again, but he's now withdrawing consciousness from all external activity and fixing consciousness exclusively upon Krishna. This is the at the time of death program. That might be my cell phone. Yeah, just can take a number or whatever it is. By pure meditation, looking at Lord Sri Krishna, he at once was freed from all material inauspiciousness. How was Bhishma Dev covered by any material inauspiciousness? Any material inauspiciousness before that moment? Any idea how that's possible? It's mentioned in the purport. I'll go on and we'll come back. And was relieved of all bodily pains caused by arrow wounds. So it's one thing to tolerate pain and it's another thing to not even feel pain. He was not feeling pain because his ecstasy increased even beyond where his ecstasy was before. Thus, all external activities of his senses at once stopped, and he prayed transcendentally to the controller of all living beings while quitting his material body, and the prayers of Bhishma Dev is what follows. So there's another step where it says, and his reactions to work all ended. As long as there's contact through extending consciousness through matter, although consciousness may not be, consciousness is pure, but there may be, just like you pass light through a colored lens, or you know, we could paint the light bulb blue or red or yellow. The light that's coming from the bulb itself is clear light or white light. When you paint the bulb some color, and the light comes out that color, passing through that filter. So, unavoidably so, when we extend our consciousness, even Bhishma Dev extending consciousness through the senses, there's the filter of the material energy. Not that his consciousness was contaminated. but the appearance of, how to say this, the only way I can think of it is to say it is in a comparison. Like light passing through a filter, there's the appearance of ordinary consciousness. So he withdrew his consciousness from all activities, and thus at once all material inauspiciousness was removed, the filtering of that consciousness, the bodily pains, because consciousness was withdrawn, bodily pains went away, all external activities stopped, and now he's going to speak, which is also an external activity, but it's exclusively focused upon Krishna. So Bhishma said, let me now invest my thinking, feeling, and willing. Thinking, feeling, and willing are powers of the mind. Right? In sequence. You think about something, and those things that you think about, there's some feelings arise. I like the color of the wall. I don't like the color of the wall, let's change the color. I like this prasadam, I don't like this prasadam. I like this, I don't like that. I like this person, whatever it is. I like the fan on, I don't like the fan on. I like this, I don't like that. Think that we think about, there's some feelings about those things, particularly attraction, repulsion, like, dislike. And then willing, I think I'll turn the fan at a faster speed, I think I'll turn the fan off. I want to do something about this thing I'm attracted to or repulsed from. Thinking, feeling, willing, and it's followed by acting. So any action is preceded by a mental action. And the mind takes help from the intelligence. The intelligence assesses this and that. Discriminates. So the stage that Bhishma Dev is in, it's pure meditation. The mind is not anywhere but one place, Krishna. Let me now invest my thinking, feeling, willing, which were so long engaged in different subjects and occupational duties, in the all-powerful Lord Sri Krishna. Krishna is always self-satisfied, but sometimes, being the leader of the devotees, he enjoys transcendental pleasure by descending on the material world. Although from him only, the material world is created. Bhishma Dev likes making this point because he makes it again and again. Krishna is transcendental, but he's very loving and merciful. So this world which he creates, sometimes for the pleasure of his devotees, he comes here. And here he is, but we should know that although here he is, he's the original personality of Godhead. He's not one of us. He's clear. He likes declaring that fact. Why does he do that? He enjoys transcendental pleasure. And what is his transcendental pleasure? Giving pleasure to his devotees. Reciprocating in exchanges of love with his devotees. Including subordinating himself to the love of his devotees. This is this Anubhav idea that we were discussing this morning. It's part of the glories of Krishna. Although he has nothing to do with this place, other than creating it, at his will, out of his leisure and pleasure, he sometimes comes. And when he's done, he goes. And he remains unchanged, here and gone. Now, in the purport, Prabhupada is making a very important point. Bhishma Dev is instructing this transcendental, wonderful knowledge to Yudhisthira Maharaj. But there are some people that are, they're inimical to Krishna, unlike Maharaj Yudhisthira. And for such people, Krishna doesn't interfere. Their desire to try to chase after illusory happiness, he sanctions that. And such persons, he also never discloses his identity. They're not interested. It's not that Krishna doesn't care about them, but he doesn't interfere. For the ordinary man who wants to lord it over material nature, the Lord not only sanctions and becomes a witness of his activities, but he never gives the non-devotees instructions to go back to Godhead. Now one might think, well, that's not nice. Why not? Because they don't want, and he's reciprocating with their desires. That's the nature of our Lord, which tells us that if we desire, he'll reciprocate. He'll give us instructions. He also wants to see, are you prepared to follow those instructions? And when he sees, and assists us to, even when we're finding it difficult to follow the instructions, he assists us to follow the instructions that he gives himself. That is the difference in dealings by the Lord with the different living beings, the devotees and the non-devotees. So, it's not a hard choice, is it? Which do you want? Be a devotee. Be a devotee. Make the choice to be a devotee. Because there's always the option, let me try being a non-devotee for a while. Let me just let my senses go where they want to go and enjoy and see what it's like. Oh. a devotee, I'll be a devotee. And it happens like that. So, because the devotees are devoted, they're attached to Krishna, their activities are above good and bad. And because Krishna is Krishna, his activities are above good and bad. He's not attracted to the material world or repulsed by the material world. He comes here, he performs activities for his devotees, and he leaves the place. He doesn't come here for a while and say, hey, this is pretty good, I'm going to just stay around. He's not attached. He's aloof. Although he's aloof, he comes. It's a mystery. Because we don't come in material consciousness. People don't go anywhere or do anything unless they're going to get something. That's not Krishna. Just for his devotees, he comes. And then he goes. Now, it gets more ecstatic because he's just now going to focus upon specifically Krishna standing in front of him in his four-armed form. Bhishma Dev wants, he's preparing to leave his body, and even Krishna standing before him, his full concentration goes to Krishna on the battlefield. And that's what he's going to now describe. Sri Krishna is the intimate friend of Arjuna, and that manifests itself on the battlefield. He has appeared on this earth in his transcendental body, which resembles a bluish color of the tamal tree. You've seen a tamal tree before? Have you been to Vrindavan? No, not this lifetime, huh? Not yet. You've been there, but you can't remember?
He's been there, but he has not seen a tamal tree.
Did you go to the Krishna Balaram temple? You went to Vrindavan, you saw Krishna Balaram, right? Right in the middle of the courtyard, there's a tamal tree. And it's that color, bluish color. Darkish, bluish. Sometimes the color of Krishna is compared to the monsoon cloud, sometimes to the color of a tamal tree. So next time you go to Vrindavan, you can check it out. That's Krishna's color. Dark color. Dark bluish color. His body attracts everyone in the three planetary systems. May his glittering yellow dress... Now he's just meditating on how Krishna is attired. And his lotus face, covered with paintings of sandalwood pulp, be the object of my attraction, and may I not desire fruitive results. So, two things. His consciousness is fixed just out of spontaneous attraction upon Krishna in this chivalrous rasa. You may have heard this before, but it's nice to hear it again. There, in the science of nectar of devotion, how many rasas are identified? There's 12 rasas. There's 5 primary and 7 secondary. 5 plus 7 equals 12, right? 5 plus 7 is 12. So the five primary rasas, Bhishma's over here. There's Shanta rasa, Dasya rasa, Sakya rasa, Vatsalya rasa, Madhurya rasa. So Bhima's over here. Bhishma. Dasya. Servitorship. So how can a servant of Krishna fire arrows at Krishna's body? How can a servant of Krishna take a vow, I'm going to kill Krishna's best friend before the sun sets? Or Krishna will have to break his promise. One who has pure devotion and dasya rasa. Pretty extraordinary. It's because there's a secondary rasa called chivalry that says, Krishna likes a good fight, let me give Krishna a good fight. For Krishna's pleasure. And Krishna knows that Bhishma was fighting in devotion. And so when Bhishma was firing arrows and piercing the body of Krishna, it was ecstasy for Krishna. And when Arjuna was firing the arrows that were piercing the body of Grandfather Bhishma, Bhishma was in ecstasy. That's not what Kamsa felt, ecstasy. Because he wasn't a devotee. It's not what Karna felt when Arjuna's arrows destroyed Karna. But Bhishma was feeling ecstasy. Bhishma's attraction was drawn by the glittering dress of Krishna. And indirectly he admired his so-called enemy, Arjuna, for possessing the Lord as his friend. Bhishma was on the opposite side of Krishna so he could see Krishna's face. Krishna was the chariot driver of Arjuna, so he was seeing Krishna's back. Bhishma was seeing his face. And with the setting of the sun, the dhoti of Krishna was glittering or radiating, reflecting the light of the sun. So he's just meditating on this image of Krishna on the battlefield. Now while he's absorbed in this meditation, still he's praying, may I not desire fruitive results. To me, what that means is this thing of fruitive results is like a stain that's really hard to get rid of. It's deeply rooted. And there's a good reason why Krishna spends so much time in Bhagavad Gita, so many verses dedicated to non-fruitive work, working with detachment, detachment from the fruits of work, karma palatyag, karma yoga, dedicating the fruits to Krishna, detachment from the fruits of work, again and again and again, so many ways. Because we're so attached. It's the pride in the heart. I want to enjoy that which I have created. It's so deep. I'm the creator, and therefore I'm the enjoyer. Therefore, the spirit of devotion, on the one hand, the spirit of devotion is checked by that fruitive mentality. But on the other hand, the spirit of devotion is the cure for that fruitive mentality. I'll tell a little Prabhupada story in connection with this. Once Prabhupada was with a group of devotees in the late afternoon, just before the evening arati in class. And Prabhupada, in a very light-hearted manner, was asking the devotees, "What is the difference between you and me?" And the devotees were having a great time saying, "Prabhupada, you're this and we're that. You're that and we're nothing." And Prabhupada was looking for a specific thing, and he said, after they had a good time discussing their differences, Prabhupada said, "The difference is that you can fall down and I cannot." "Jai, Prabhupada." "We can fall down and you cannot." And then they went to arati, greeting the deities and then class. And when Prabhupada was before the deities with his hands folded, he was silently or very softly speaking some prayers. Then he went, sat on the Vyasasan, led kirtan, gave class, and went back to his room after class. And his secretary approached Prabhupada after class and said, "Prabhupada, when you were before the deities reciting those prayers, what were those prayers that you were reciting?" And Prabhupada said, "I was praying to Krishna that I never fall prey to Maya." And the devotee said, "But Prabhupada, you said you can never fall prey to Maya, you can never fall down." And Prabhupada's answer was, "Now you understand why. Because I'm always praying to Krishna, please keep me engaged in your service, please protect me from Maya." Always praying like that. The pure devotee, although pure devotee, is always praying, "Please keep me always engaged in your service and free from Maya." Free in here, Bhishma Dev, praying to Krishna, who's standing before him, the pure devotee praying to his pure object of worship and love. He knows clearly who he is. "Please keep me free from the tendency for fruitive activity, desiring fruitive results." Very instructive. This is the natural quality of humility of a great devotee. It's why they're great devotees. They're thinking of themselves not great devotees. They're thinking of themselves needing Krishna's protection at every moment. So now back to the battlefield. Bhishma says, looking at Krishna, his eyes are wide open and he's looking at Krishna and he's speaking to everybody can hear, but he's speaking to Krishna. On the battlefield, where Sri Krishna tended Arjuna out of friendship, the flowing hair of Lord Krishna turned ashen due to the dust raised by the hooves of the horses. And because of his labor, beads of sweat wetted his face. All these decorations, intensified by the wounds dealt by my sharp arrows, were enjoyed by him. Let my mind go thus unto Sri Krishna. And he's preparing to give up his body. This is the feature of Krishna that he wants to think of. It's what excites Bhishma the most. And, you know, the artist, I can imagine that the artists that have the capacity to draw such things, it's a meditation for them. Krishna's hair flowing in the wind as he's racing towards Grandfather Bhishma, his hair and face ashen from the hooves raised by the dust raised by the hooves of the horses on the battlefield, beads of perspiration rolling down his face because the intensity of his efforts, his body wounded with arrows, raising the broken chariot wheel of Arjuna, running to bash Bhishma. Ecstasy. Chivalrous ecstasy. He's got Krishna right next to him. That's the feature of Krishna that excites him the most. He knows who Krishna is from the spiritual world, the original Narayan, situated in the heart of every living being, the creator of the universe, enters into it, performs activities with all of his devotees, but this is the feature of Krishna that Bhishma wants to meditate upon. It most attracts him. Bhishma is a very special devotee. In obedience to the command of his friend, Lord Sri Krishna entered the arena of the battlefield of Kurukshetra between the soldiers of Arjuna and Duryodhana. And while there, he shortened the lifespan of the opposite party by his merciful glance. Die. And be liberated. This was done simply by his looking at the enemy. Let my mind be fixed upon that Krishna. When Arjuna was seemingly polluted by ignorance upon observing the soldiers and commanders before him on the battlefield, the Lord eradicated his ignorance by delivering transcendental knowledge. May his lotus feet always remain the object of my attraction. Fulfilling my desires and sacrificing his own promise. What was his desire? His desire was to see, just see. I want everyone to see the quality of Krishna. He places the well-being of his devotee above his own promise. He'll break his promise first and protect his devotee, rather than let his devotee be in difficulty to keep his promise. That is Krishna. Everyone see. This is the kind of personality he is. Such a loving personality. Let people say bad things about him because he broke his promise. I love him because of that. Because it's just protection of his devotee. It's more to him than himself. He got down from the chariot, took up its wheel, and ran towards me hurriedly, just like a lion goes to kill an elephant. He even dropped his outer garment on the way. I mean, details. You know, he had this nice chadar, and forget the chadar, smash Bhishma. Protect Arjuna. This is dear devotee. It's like Advaita Acharya in ecstasy when Lord Chaitanya finally chastised him. They began dancing and dancing and dancing. Lord Chaitanya was going to beat him and he just started dancing and dancing. Finally, at last, he's chastised me. Because Bhishma was Grandfather Bhishma, everyone's offering all praises and respect. Krishna is his master. Krishna, take the position of being my master. Come and bash me. Haribo. It's not just getting bashed, it's protecting his devotee. How glorious is Krishna? He's relishing the qualities of Krishna. He's relishing the form of Krishna. He's relishing the exchange of love between Krishna and his devotees. He's relishing the elevated position of the devotees in the intimate relation with Krishna, like Arjuna. He's preparing himself to leave his body in that consciousness. May He, Lord Sri Krishna, the Personality of Godhead, who awards salvation, be my ultimate destiny. Forget salvation. Let me just be with Krishna, whatever that means. Let me just be with Krishna. On the battlefield, He charged me as if angry because of the wounds dealt by my sharp arrows. His shield was scattered, and His body was smeared with blood due to His wounds. He's not like reveling blood. He's reveling the unfolding of the drama that Krishna was displaying. Prabhupada writes, the dealings of Lord Krishna and Bhishma Dev on the battlefield of Kurukshetra are exceptionally interesting because the activities of Lord Sri Krishna appear to be partial to Arjuna and at enmity with Bhishma, but factually, this was especially meant to show special favor to Bhishma. In italics, the astounding feature of such dealings is that a devotee can please the Lord by playing the part of an enemy. There was no inimical feeling toward Krishna, but he very capably and expertly performed that role for Krishna's pleasure. For Krishna's pleasure. A devotee only does things for one reason, for Krishna's pleasure. Grandfather Bhishma was constantly, consciously giving Krishna pleasure. Everything that he did. And seemingly contrary to Krishna's wish, but not so. Bhishmadeva is a very wonderful character, very wonderful personality in the Srimad Bhagavatam and Mahabharata. So end. See if we have any comments or discussion. Questions? Okay. Yes.
Maharaj, fruit and desire, you mentioned, is such a sticky thing. Here, mature devotee prays like this. And it's common experience that as practicing devotees, I personally experience that in everything there is some fruit of it. There is a stain of fruit of desire, or there is always a coloring. Then, how do we feel satisfied that we are doing devotional service? It's kind of a little discouraging. It kind of weighs on the mind where there is fruit of desire and everything that I do.
Did you hear the question? Well, the position of being a practicing devotee, like we are all trying to be practicing devotees, we become familiar with this very interesting space or situation where there's satisfaction and there's not satisfaction simultaneously. There's the satisfaction that encourages us to go further, and the dissatisfaction that we're not where we want to be. So, if that we must learn the transcendental art of turning that dissatisfaction of not being where we want to be as an impetus to go further, as opposed to the mode of ignorance where we just lament. And certainly there's room for more joy in the heart, although the heart may feel great joy and a sense of either fulfillment, maybe a sense of accomplishment, but you know, a sense of connection that's not like anything you find in the material existence. So it's real, it's genuine, that's encouragement. And this stain is still there. So let that be impetus to go, to keep scrubbing. Look at the expressions of Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami. I have no good qualification. I'm the lowest of the low. I'm lower than a worm in stool. And it's not just, oh, isn't that an interesting, humble thing to say. It's how he feels. Or Rupa and Sanatan Goswami saying, we are fit candidates for you because you're the savior of the most fallen. We're more fallen than Jagai and Madhai. And it's not just, oh, that's cute, nice thing to say. It's how they feel. So, after the yatra in Jagannath Puri, that one of my realizations, or like very strong impressions that I carried from that, was the leelas of very, very elevated transcendental emotions exhibited two seemingly opposing moods. One mood is an unrestricted eagerness to achieve the spiritual objective of life in so many different leelas and so many different persons. At the same time, a seemingly opposite mood of such strong feelings of disqualification. And the balance of those, that they're not, they're completely complementary. They're not, they, although materially they appear to be opposite. If I'm unqualified, I might as well just throw in the towel and forget it. What's the use of even trying? That's where it's win-lose. And it looks like I'm on the lose side. But it's the humility that allows for the purity of egoless action. Egoless action is where I'm endeavoring completely dependent upon Krishna. That's humility and great eagerness at the same time. Or another way of saying the same thing is in Rupa Goswami's description of the symptoms of bhava. Asha Bhanda, great hope. Although I have no qualification, I don't have high birth, I don't have any good learning, I don't have anything. I'm strong material desire, strong material attraction, and I'm shameless. Although I have no qualification, I'm eagerly preying upon you, or praying unto you, to please engage me in your devotional service, which is the most rare thing to achieve. And my only hope is that knowing the fact that you're a completely merciful person. And that's bhava, the symptom of ecstasy. So, take that and just add to the list. And I have this constant thing of attachment to fruit, of enjoying the fruits of my activities. Maybe not in a gross way, but in a subtle way, and that thing is always there. What's my qualification? But I do have one hope, and you are the hope against hope. That's how Prabhupada uses the phrase. That you're merciful and you'll remove this. And that's similar here. Protect me from that. Anyone else? Okay.
So, to overcome the
to overcome fruitive desire, what is the instruction for us? Overcome fruitive desire. Do it. There's the pile of rocks, and move them. Fruitive desire is connected to false ego. It's connected to misidentification of the self with the body. And although one might think understanding the self to be different than the body, that's ABC. Tell me something higher. Prabhupada writes in one purported Bhagavad Gita, I'm trying to recall which one it is. Might be Vyavasayatmi Kabuddhi verse, the purport, that the perfection of Krishna consciousness is becoming freed from the material conception of life. Because when you're freed from the material conception of life, you're also freed from thinking yourself to be the creator of results and therefore the enjoyer of those results. Mine is connected to I. So, in short, to keep it real short and simple, practice, the instruction is practice or cultivate rendering service in a humble service mood. Without deviation. To do that, there has to be a spiritual conception of self, a real conception of humility. If you do your activities for Krishna, the results belong to Krishna. Anything? Pure devotees get direct reciprocation from Krishna. What about the rest of us? That's your question? Oh, that's your question. Well, what would your answer to that be? Krishna just neglects us, right? Come back again later when you're a pure devotee. Krishna, when we're engaged in devotional service, whether it's sadhana bhakti, bhava bhakti, or prema bhakti. When we're engaged in devotional service, we're in contact with the internal energy of Krishna. Krishna takes full charge as long as we're placing ourselves in that position of being in His care. He's the master, and we're the servant. So, our consciousness may be covered, but devotional service is pure. And Krishna accepts our service directly. So it's direct contact. When we're chanting Krishna's name, Krishna is there. He's not elsewhere, he's there. Our consciousness may be elsewhere, but Krishna is there. Reciprocation is direct. You call Krishna's name and he's there. There's no, not even a fraction of a moment's delay. He's there. But while you're calling Krishna's name, your mind may be on your duties for tomorrow or something. Reciprocation is direct and immediate and proportionate to the genuine affection that we have for Krishna. We'll experience Krishna's presence or not. Like that example from the story this morning, the guru that came back after reading Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita with tears in his eyes, and then the person sold him the book thinking, why don't I cry like that? So we'll just assume that those were genuine tears, not something else. That means the person genuinely wanted Krishna more intensely, more ardently than even the person who provided them with the book. Now it doesn't mean the person that's providing with the book, that their contact with Krishna is less direct. Our contact with Krishna is direct, their intensity for eagerness for Krishna may be less intense. The feelings that we're feeling, the experiences that we experience may be different. But Krishna is there. His internal potency is there. That is our teaching. That is what Rupa Goswami teaches. Sadhana bhakti and bhava bhakti, as well as prema bhakti, it's all uttam bhakti. If there's this cultivation of anyabhilashita shunyam jnana karma janavratam. So we may not be there, but Krishna's there, reciprocating and purifying and bringing us to that stage. Okay. Anything else? Last time. Okay. See the Prabhupada ki jaya.